the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and this morning, in our ongoing series on iconic local residents from the past, present, and in between, Jay Burke and I speak with Park City resident Nick Como, who talks about how he chose this mountain town to live in and how he shares his love of skiing at Sundance Mountain Resort, where he's the vice president of marketing. And then our guest and psycholinguist Julie Sedevi tracks the path that language takes through a human life, from a baby's first intuition of the pure mathematics of sound to the vulnerabilities and limitations that come with aging as we lose our words. That conversation with co-host Mary Beth Maziarz. These guests when we return. You're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Jay Burke.
Well, fall is firmly here and winter just around the corner. Today on The Mountain Life, we are circling back to a series that we started. It's the Past, Present, and In-Between series, which takes a look at some of our iconic residents who put meaning to the term The Mountain Life. Today, Nick Como joins us. Nick is a Summit County resident and falls into the category of in-between. He's not long past, but he has been here for almost a decade along with his wife, and he works in the ski and tourism industry. He's the current vice president of marketing for Sundance Mountain Resort. Having grown up in New York City, he's a perfect individual to visit with about this wonderful place we all call home and what originally drew him in, pizza here in Utah. Nick Como, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me. I thought I was in the wrong place when you said iconic resident. I was like, oh gosh, I'm in the wrong Zoom. But I appreciate the intro and thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's really nice to talk to you. We're excited to talk about some of the upcoming and current changes happening at Sundance Mountain Resort, because Sundance, I feel like everyone in Summit County really, and Wasatch County, hold Sundance dear in their hearts, Sundance Resort. But first of all, we want to talk about you from Queens to Park City and everywhere in between. I see a lot of people coming from big cities and somehow they get a taste of the mountains and they never go back. Tell us about your journey.
And you're exactly right. As soon as I got that first taste of the mountains, I never looked back. So yeah, I grew up in New York and did all the city kid stuff, played baseball and took the train into the city to go to music shows and all that fun stuff. But when I was in high school, my aunt and uncle took me skiing in upstate New York, which a lot of people are surprised to realize that New York has actually a fair amount of and pretty good skiing a few hours from the city. And that turned me on to a whole new way of life of hanging out in a cabin and skiing. And then in the summers, fly fishing and hiking. And it was just the exact opposite of where I was from, which I think a lot of people kind of, you know, human nature draws you to the opposite of what you have. And it was the exact opposite of growing up, with a view of an apartment building behind my house to going up to the Adirondacks with a stream flowing behind a cabin. And it was just eyes wide open. And then I was very, very fortunate that same aunt and uncle that took me under their wing and taught me to ski. I have a cousin who worked at the Alta Peruvian Lodge for a winter, and I forget what the deal was, like, you know, get straight A's and blah, 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 save up for a plane ticket and we'll get you on this ski trip. And I'll never forget the first drive up Little Cottonwood. I'm like, yep, this is it. This is what I'm doing. I was, a junior in high school or a sophomore in high school. I was like, yep, this is, as soon as I'm done with college, I'm coming directly here.
Oh, that's great. I love to hear the very tiny, sometimes twist of fate that make someone end up in, say, Park City versus, you know, the Tahoe area or Colorado. And it sounds like it was the cousin at Alta for you.
Yeah. And I had a bit of a wayward path to Utah because, you know, at least back then, this is in the late 90s, like Utah still felt a little bit weird, I guess you could say, especially coming from New York, it would have been a pretty big culture shock. So I opted to move to Summit County, Colorado, which is kind of like the gateway to skiing for so many, you know, residents and guests and all that sort of stuff. And I lived there for 3 years and did the ski bump thing, right? Drove vans to the airport. I was probably the fastest driver on the road coming from New York. Great, great job for a city kid. Put them behind a 10 passenger van full of trucks coming up by 70. You know, worked in ski shops and had just such a good time and had roommates and, you know, walking distance to Main Street, Frisco and Breckenridge. It was so much fun. But there was no jobs. There was no future in living in those ski towns. I had a degree. I had advertising agency experience. I had worked on Park Avenue through college, and just couldn't find a reasonable job in Summit County, Colorado. And I was coming to Utah for ski trips multiple times in winter. I was like, well, this is ridiculous. Like, why? I don't know. And Utah's not weird. Like, I think that's just a population control device locals are using. And I just jumped in with 2 feet, and my aunt and uncle, same aunt and uncle who, you know, took me to the Peruvian, were longtime locals at the Alta Rustler Lodge. And the GM of that hotel was becoming the mayor of Alta. And he said, you know, we're going to be hiring a marketing person for the town of Alta. And lo and behold, I was able to get that job. And that's how I landed in Utah.
And thanks for getting that job, because that's right after that when I scooped you up to work at Solitude.
Yeah.
Which was awesome.
Another incredible twist of fate. And here we are, however many years, 15 years later, still buds and hanging out and skiing right. And biking. It's fantastic.
Well, tell us a little bit more about the journey. I mean, as far as like into the ski industry, and then, you know, how'd you eventually land up here? Like, what were the next steps? I mean, Solitude was one.
Yeah. And I was, you know, very fortunate that, you know, you scooped me up, right? And I was able to work at Solitude for 6 or 7 winters and had hundreds of great, great powder days there. And Solitude was a different resort then, as you remember. It was, you know, owned by a family. It was really off the beaten path. It was kind of stuck in between Park City and the Cottonwoods. And, you know, it was great. Like, you could drive up there on a Saturday afternoon and park in front of the lodge and hop on the lift and ski powder right underneath the chair in the afternoon. And that's certainly not the case now, as the ski industry has changed and Solitude's changed and adapted with it. But it was a pretty special time to learn from, you know, I would consider both UJ and Connie Marshall at Alta two of my first mentors in the ski industry that really showed me the ropes and gave me introductions to groups like Ski Utah and Office of Tourism, where I've been able to make lifelong friendship and have colleagues that have looked out for each other through my journey. So, you know, I did those 2 years at Alta, which was a great launch pad into really just cutting my teeth in the ski industry. And then, of course, working with you at Solitude, where, you know, we were a real marketing department doing real things and learned so much about how to work with Powder Magazine and Free Skier Magazine, who we did those ski tests with, and all the different angles. Like, marketing, as you know, isn't just taking out ads in papers or in magazines. There's so much more to it. And I was so fortunate to learn all of that. You know, and as things happened in the ski industry, at least back then, where it was, you know, it was pretty hard if you weren't in like the top 5% of the executive level to have a career path. There wasn't a whole lot of room for opportunity like there is now. And, you know, as you and I both kind of cycled through those jobs, I decided, you know, maybe I should, you know, blend my New York City past with my current ski future. And I wound up getting a job in downtown Salt Lake for the downtown Salt Lake Alliance, who is a nonprofit that partnered with the Salt Lake Chamber and, you know, worked on, you know, I always kind of compared them to a mullet. Like, there was the business up front and the party in the back, right? So the business up front, we're doing economic development and art and entertainment districts. And then on the backside, we're doing the farmer's market and the bike share program and all these cool things that were ahead of their time. And the leader I had there, who was another great mentor in my life, Jason Mathis, was, you know, great about letting us take chances and really run with ideas and see what stuck. And that was a really fun learning experience. And I got to be there for, I think, 6 or 7 years. And from there, I had always wanted to go back to the agency world. So my wife had kind of started working on Park Avenue in New York at a, I would call it an ad agency, but an ad agency for the 1990s, which the world was much different. And I was super fortunate once again to get a job at Number Six, which ultimately became Struck, or my job became part of Struck, which is a very famous agency in Salt Lake that did a lot of the Utah Office of Tourism Mighty Five work. They did that one-star campaign for Snowbird that everybody seems to notice. And I got to be around all these uber creative people who loved skiing and loved marketing and advertising all day, every day. And I like to feel like through osmosis, I absorbed some of their creativity. And to be honest, I was pretty darn happy there until the Sundance job opened up.
Yeah. Well, was it during that period that, you know, you started to look up here to the Wasatch back and maybe getting out of the Salt Lake area? And I mean, what was it that really drew you in?
So this is when I was still working at the Chamber. It was actually my first couple of years working at the Chamber in the Downtown Alliance. You know, my wife and I we had just gotten married. We were living in Salt Lake, having a great time. We had a house down there. And unfortunately, she was diagnosed with thyroid cancer. And one of the biggest challenges that we were facing was the air quality in Salt Lake. Everything else about Salt Lake we really, really liked and enjoyed, but the air quality was just not helping her heal. And I had never really thought about living in Park City. I just thought of like, I ski in the Wasatch Front and I go ping in the Wasatch back in the summer and never shall the two meet. And then we started thinking, okay, we have to leave this valley. You know, we could go to Boise or Sedona or wherever, but like, why wouldn't we just go to Park City? It's right around the corner. And yeah, thus began about a year search to find a house that fit for us. This is about 8 years ago now. So housing was, you know, back then I thought it was expensive, but looking back now, like, boy, I'm glad we did it when we did it.
I'm glad you got in.
We are, what would you say, like air, the exodus out of the air quality in Salt Lake was really what drove us up here. And as soon as we got here, you know, we live in Pine Brook and have trails at our back door. It's like, what took us so long? Like, this has been here our whole adult lives and we just missed it. I'm glad we did it when we did it.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Nick Como. He is a Summit County resident, and he's also the vice president of marketing for Sundance Mountain Resort.
A close 45 minutes from Park City. I'll just sneak a plug in there while you're not.
Always marketing. That's the job of a vice president of marketing.
Attaboy, attaboy.
Always marketing. And that's,
Taught me well there, Jay.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask you this question because you're talking about working in Salt Lake and working for the Downtown Alliance and probably very closely associated with, you know, Visit Salt Lake and the Chamber and all that, and then deciding to leave Salt Lake because of the air quality. I'm kind of curious, what is your overall take on how some of these organizations deal with the air quality question? And we notice here in Park City, after being here a long time and having kids here, the young people now, they don't want to live in Park City. They love Salt Lake because it's fun and vibrant and urban, and they're having a great time there. But that question, that one sticking point still exists about air quality.
Yeah, I think 20 years ago, it was something that leaders tried to kind of sweep under the rug, and that's just no longer an option. You can't do it. There's too much data out there and too many people who have been affected by it. And one thing I think Utah does really, really well compared to other states is work together. And you see it with a lot of the challenges that are happening with the Great Salt Lake itself, the lake itself drying up. And, you know, there's a huge economic reason to do it, but there's also health reasons to do it. And I'd say the same thing with air quality. There's health reasons to do it, but there's also economic reasons to be mindful of it, because more people are moving to Salt Lake, and you certainly want to attract businesses to relocate here who are going to bring in top level talent, and that's going to bring money with it. And if you just try to ignore problem air quality in a lake drying up and sweep it under the rug, it's going to bite you in the long run. And I think this next generation that's coming in has their priorities aligned, and they'll make it work. And I think that trickled down to so many other things too, like affordable housing, which is a challenge not only in Park City, but also in Salt Lake. And you start to see some adaptive reuse of commercial space that isn't used as much during, you know, because of the pandemic, and turning that into affordable housing. And, you know, it takes a long time to get things done in a big city, but cities are resilient. They're smart. They attract smart people. And I think Salt Lake's going to figure it out, because we need them to figure it out.
We sure do. Yeah, all of us. And we'll be looking at the same sort of issues on the Wasatch back with air quality as we expand, you know, especially in Wasatch County. I wanted to ask you about this. You know, we have been sort of force-fed Vail and Alterra, and it's great. You know, we love our icon and our epic passes and things like that. But I feel like at the end of the day, the quote-unquote mom-and-pop ski resort will prosper, because it's just the mega conglomerate is taxing on our psyche. But Sundance, is that the plan for Sundance, to kind of stay mom and pop? Can you talk about that?
That's exactly the plan. If you've ever watched the movie Out Cold, there's that line in it where they're like, Bull Mountain, don't go changing. Like, that's how people feel about their ski resorts. Ski resorts, sports teams, and music. Like, don't, if you change those things, you'll hear it from your fan base and your local base. And, you know, Sundance, you know, to give it a very abridged history, was under Robert Redford's leadership for 50 plus years, and he did an incredible job. And his ethos was always, you know, develop a little bit and preserve a lot. And you can see that we're a, you know, a few hundred acres ski area, 500 acres, but we have thousands of acres in conservation. That's really putting your money where your mouth is. And he hand selected the new owners who follow that same approach to doing business. In fact, as soon as they bought the resort, they put even more land into conservation, which should tell you everything you need to know about them. But also they were able to invest money in the ski resort in areas where we hadn't been able to do to keep up and compete with the Park Cities and Deer Valleys. And, you know, we needed a new high speed lift and we did that. We needed more snowmaking, did that. We needed a lot more parking. We did that too. And now of course we're building the inn, but it's a small inn. It's 63 rooms, not 163 or whatever else. Like it's going to still be Sundance sized. And I agree with you, Lynn. I think there's an appetite for independent ski areas and Sundance, both under the Redfords ownership as well as our new ownership group, is a fiercely independent resort. And that just makes us different. And I think that's what makes the ski industry special is that there is so much differentiation in it. And, you know, Park City and Deer Valleys are really the tip of that spear, especially for Utah. Like they're drawing people here into Utah, putting Utah on the ski map. And Sundance is only going to benefit from that. We're only going to benefit from the Deer Valley East Village bringing a lot more skiers 20 minutes closer to us. And as Heber and Wasatch Valley grows, it only helps bring more people to us who can discover, hey, this is just a different experience, not better or worse, just a totally different experience to come to Sundance and have this throwback rustic feel of kind of like the place you grew up skiing, wherever that may be. Like that's the way you feel when you're at Sundance.
Well, and it is definitely within, you know, that kind of hour throw of all the resorts we have right here. I mean, it is that one spot where you can still experience that, which is great. And I hope you all maintain that as you're planning to. It's such a special part of skiing. I mean, definitely for those of us, and I know there are listeners out there that, you know, grew up skiing the mom and pop's place. So hats off to y'all. Keep that up. I want to swing it back to Park City, Wasatch, back here in our community and ask you a question that I want to try to ask everyone that we have on in this little series. And that's, you know, the one thing in Park City that you feel is just paramount to your existence here, you know, that one organization, that one spot, like what is that for you and Laura?
For us, that's an easy question. It is the trails right outside our back door. Like we can roll out our garage. We call our garage our trailhead here in Pinebrook, and I can ride all the way through Park City and into Deer Valley on single track and cross pavement maybe once. Like to have access to the trail system that we have here for hikes, bikes, rides is just cross-country skiing in the winter is just something you don't get everywhere. And we're just so fortunate that we landed here and have access to the outdoors and all the open space that Park City's been so smart in preserving.
Yeah, and I'm sure you could, you'll shout that, you know, I mean, the beauty of that is to be so close to such a metro area as well, you know, I mean, that really is to me and my wife anyway, that's like such an important piece of the puzzle up here. And I mean, we're not the only ones that know that.
Yeah. A few years ago, we thought it was our little secret, but yeah. Other folks have figured it out.
A few years ago. Conversely though, so what, I mean, in your like sphere, what's something that you feel, you know, we need to be on top of and be addressing like right now today, you know, in the community?
I think one of the biggest things Park City can do is really dial in our transportation logistics. You know, and that goes from Interstate 80 to 40 in that interchange, how people get into Main Street and Old Town, whether that's through 224 or 248. I think those were built in what, the 70s or 80s with the capacity of the 70s and 80s in mind and not the needs of 2024 and beyond. And, you know, I think one of the things that Utah as a state did really well and Park City did pretty well with too, with the last Olympics, was building up infrastructure. You know, like Salt Lake did I-215 and I-80 and tracks line down there. And if we can take some of that money that's going to come in from the Olympics and really think through how people get into our community and how they get around our community. And, you know, the car's not going away and it's part of the solution as our bus lanes and bike lanes. And how do we use 224 and 248 together rather than they're kind of working against each other? I think if we can take a step back and think like, what are the needs of this community for the next 10 years, the next 20 years, and how do we build for that? I think that would be a game changer for residents and also for visitors that come to our community.
Also within the Olympics, what kind of role will Sundance Resort play, if any?
We're not an Olympic venue. You know, we hope that people that come pre or post Olympics will come certainly stay with us 10 years from now. But you know, no, we're not an Olympic venue. But we do have an Olympic skier who also lives here in Park City, Stephen Nyman, who cut his teeth at Sundance. So I'm sure we'll be doing some fun collaborations and looking back at his career and you know, promoting him and his relationship with our resort that bred at least one or two pro and Olympic skiers. And who knows what'll happen in 10 years. There could be some other Sundance skiers that are on the podium in 2034 here in Park City.
That is such a great opportunity for Sundance. And I mean, as you know, Solitude back in 2002 wasn't an Olympic venue either, but the spike that was realized after the Olympics was just incredible in the spotlight that it put on it. And it was one of those resorts that you could get to and go skiing while people were here enjoying the Olympics. So we hope the same for Sundance, but not in a tidal wave fashion, of course.
Just ride the coattails. That's all. Ride the coattails of everything else that's happening in our state, including the Olympics.
Well, Nick, it's been great speaking with you. And before we let you go, could we get an overview of all the exciting new things going on at Sundance Mountain Resort, including the new base lodge and then the inn?
So yeah, that's the inn at Sundance, or the inn at Sundance Mountain Resort. That's going to be 63 rooms, and that'll be open a little less than a year and a half from now. So about 2025, 2026 ski season, hopefully right around the holidays. And at the same time, we're also building a day lodge for all of our day skiers, which is so important to us, whether they're coming from Provo in Utah County or from Wasatch County in Heber, or certainly I think more people from Park City and Salt Lake are going to start to gravitate to us when they realize it's pretty much all highway miles. And I wouldn't say we guarantee parking, but pretty darn close that there's a good chance you're going to find a spot there outside of most of the busier Saturdays. So those are two of the big projects that we have going on right now. We've also completed a whole lot of other projects. Like I mentioned, adding new parking. We upgraded that old raised chairlift, which was a 23-minute fixed grip ride with a 7-minute high-speed lift, Outlaw Express. And you know, if you draw a line in the sand when, you know, Robert Redford sold the resort to our new ownership group, we started to call this our Act Two era, you know, with the whole theater play on words there, right? Of, you know, this is our second act. It's a lot of the same characters, the same backdrop, same scene. But, you know, there's been a change, and I hope people look at it and see it's a change for the better. We've made a lot of those necessary improvements, and almost all of the improvements we've made have really improved the day skier experience with the day lodge and some of the other renovations we've done, snow making, of course. And yeah, the inn is certainly going to appeal to destination guests, but we're also really popular with locals who come to do staycations in the shoulder seasons. It's an affordable place to play, to stay, and it just feels miles away, even though it's such a close drive. And Sundance, I've learned, is like people's special occasion place, like birthdays, graduations, anniversaries. They'll come to the Tree Room for a special dinner or come to the Owl Bar for some live music. And you know, it's cool that we have something like Sundance just 45 minutes away. And I'm in love that I get to drive there every single day and look at two beautiful mountain lakes and Mount Timpanogos. And like, this is where I get to come to work every day. This beats the heck out of taking the 7 train to Manhattan. Like, this is unbelievable. And I think other folks in Park City do the same thing. Like, they love that little commute over. And I hope they just come to visit us a little bit more than they might do these days. We'll give them a little more to do and a little more to appreciate.
And a final word about the inn, the 63-room inn. I was so happy when I saw the renderings to see that you had also incorporated into the design, the interior design, that same indescribable Sundance feel.
Yeah, when you're at Sundance, you feel like you're at Sundance. Like you could blindfold yourself and open your eyes like, oh, I'm totally at Sundance. And our goal at the inn is with that space, whether it's the living room or the check-in desk, that like, oh, it feels like Sundance from day one at new built construction rather than something that's been around 20 or 30 years. So it's got to fit in with everything else we have. And our ownership group is so thoughtful about those little touch points and what makes Sundance special. How is a little rough around the edges and not super buttoned up, but still enough rustic luxury that it's a high-end hotel. I mean, we just were awarded a Michelin One Key designation, which I think was only 4 or 5 other hotels in the state that got that. And that's, you know, level of service and like cool architecture and just being a little funky and a little different. And it's just a memorable, unique place.
Nick Como is a Summit County resident, and he is the vice president of marketing for Sundance Resort. Nick, it's been really fun speaking with you today. Thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Yeah, thanks,
Nick.
Thank
you for having me. Yeah, it's great to talk to you guys. Thank you so much.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
In the womb, infants absorb the rhythms of their native language, as our guest Julie Sedavy will tell us. They get even the cadences and the rising, falling motifs, its predilections for putting consonants together or for spacing them out. This is where our relationship with language begins, Julie tells us. It's ultimately why parents talk to those swollen bellies, predisposing them to our native language. What a beautiful concept. Our guest, Julie Sedavy, has taught linguistics and psychology at Brown University and the University of Calgary, and she's authored many books on linguistics. She joins us today to talk about her new book, Linguaphile, A Life of Language Love. Julie, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Well, so are we, because language is just so fascinating, and especially how we acquire language. And your book is in part memoir, and you talk about how when you were very young, you were exposed to all of these different languages, about five of them. Can you take us through that journey?
Yeah, so when I was about 2 years old, my family left what was then Czechoslovakia. So until about the age of two, Czech was the only language that I had been exposed to. And then we kind of wound our way through Europe, through Italy and Austria, and then eventually landed in Montreal when I was four, which has both French and English. We initially moved into a French-speaking neighborhood. So I was just constantly moved from one language environment to another. Which I think just gave me a heightened attention to language, noticing very early on that different people spoke different languages, constantly being thrown into situations where I was learning a new one. So as a result of that, I think I have some conscious memories of early language learning that maybe many other people don't have, as a result of just always being in a new environment.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because I notice when I'm places where there are many different languages spoken, you know, in Europe, people just seem to not be so up in arms about it. Yeah. We as Americans, we're highly monolingual, right? And when you go to other places, you get all stressed about, oh, that maybe they don't speak English, which they mostly do. But you see people using language in creative ways, and no one really cares about how you sound or how you don't sound. And it's pretty mind expanding. And we know that it's mind expanding in more than one way, right?
Yes. Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I think there's a comfort level with not understanding everything you hear, and an inventiveness in how to get your message across when someone else's language might be limited. So that, I think, inspires a kind of creativity and an openness that I really treasure. So when I find myself in a truly bilingual environment like Montreal in Canada, I just relish that sense of constantly negotiating between languages and using whatever's in your toolkit to manage to connect with each other.
I always think of that old joke about how when people are speaking to someone who speaks a different language than them, they speak louder, or, you know, I think the slower part is probably wise, but what are some of those ways that we adjust ourselves when speaking to someone in a different language than ours?
So it's really interesting that you mentioned that, because that is actually a learned skill, I think. And some of our instincts might not actually be correct. So people who grow up in a very monolingual environment and aren't used to speaking to non-native speakers of their own language often don't do the right things to adapt to someone with limited language skills. I remember a number of years ago, in the Czech Republic, until I think fairly recently, especially in the smaller villages, you know, if you grew up in a small village, the only Czech speakers you ever encountered were people who learned it from childhood. You didn't really have the kind of contact that we tend to have as English speakers with people who are learning our language but don't really master it yet. And the Czech government actually put out a series of hilarious ads trying to educate people how you speak or interact with someone who doesn't master the language of Czech. And speaking loudly was one of those things that, you know, don't repeat the same thing louder. have strategies for simplifying, for using gestures, try a different tack. And they were just really funny ads. And it spoke to the fact that it is, I think, a real skill to interact with people from a variety of different linguistic backgrounds and a variety of cultures too. You know, so some cultures are more direct than others in how they speak. And that can take some getting used to as well.
It sure does. When I was in high school, I was a foreign exchange student in Japan, and I didn't speak very much Japanese. We went through a little training, but it wasn't very much. And I was shocked at how much you could get across in very limited vocabulary. I mean, we would sit around the dinner table and I would too share stories, and they'd laugh at the right places or express themselves. And looking back, I noticed that even my physicality changed, the rhythm with which I spoke when I was speaking with them changed. And so that's such an interesting point. Do we just adapt?
Yes, we have tremendous capacity to adapt to different languages and different cultures, absolutely. And the kind of experience that you describe, I think, is just so valuable for precisely that. And interesting that it was in Japan, because that is a culture that really values attentiveness to body language and nonverbal cues. So that is an environment where if you can rely on some of those cues, it doesn't always have to be linguistically expressed.
Yeah, there was even this funny thing that my host mother or host father, when they would answer the phone, they would bow. And I would kind of say, well, you know, the other person can't see you. Why do you do that? And they say, well, you hear the phone moving away from your face as you bow. And these are all parts of the tradition that are part of the language, but they're also part of our physical embodiment of the language.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I've had friends tell me that when I speak on the phone with my mother or a relative in Czech, that I seem like a different person.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there is psycholinguistics. I was talking to you before we went on air about how I described you as a sociolinguist, which is much different than a psycholinguist. But can you talk about the main areas of linguistics and why specifically you have become a psycholinguist?
Sure. Yeah. So a psycholinguist is someone who studies essentially the psychological and cognitive aspects of language. So typically that falls into three categories: the learning of language, speaking, and comprehension. So those are the three big areas that fall into that category. Sociolinguists really look at how language is used in different social environments and for various social purposes. Then we have neurolinguists who study how language is instantiated in the brain. And then we have what we call theoretical linguists who study basically the information structure of language. So some of them might specialize in the sound structure of language. That would be a phonologist, or in the way that sentences are put together. That would be a syntactician. And they do a really deep dive in trying to understand what is the information that's encoded in language. What does that look like? How do we develop theories of what that structure looks like?
So you live in Calgary, and you know, when we here in the United States looked at starting dual immersion language programs, of course, we looked heavily to Canada, because you all have been in the business of dual immersion for a very long time with two official languages, French and English. And it's interesting, now we have a very vibrant dual immersion program and several schools that are fully dual immersion as elementary schools here in Park City. And so I think parents look at it as a way to enhance. It's not just about learning language. It's about what happens to your brain when you learn a second language. And can you just go over that quickly for our listeners?
Oh, so that's hard to do very quickly, because it's actually a somewhat controversial topic. And I think the research is still developing as to exactly what is happening in the bilingual brain. There's been a lot of attention to some of the brain and cognitive benefits of learning and speaking multiple languages. There have been some studies that come out that suggest that it delays the symptoms of Alzheimer's, for example, that it helps with executive functioning, which is the ability to control attention and switch between different tasks. And some studies find effects, others don't. So that's still, I think, something that is up in the air. But the sense that I have from that very large literature is that you're most likely to see benefits among populations who use their languages, multiple languages, on a daily basis. So if you just go on Duolingo and, you know, learn another language, but you don't really use it in your regular life, you may not see very many benefits to that. And the reason is that the benefits seem to be related to the fact that when we have two or more languages that are active on a regular basis, there's a competition between the two. So if you're in a bilingual environment, you'll often see people switching even mid-sentence from one language to another. Both of those languages are active in their brains at the same time, often vying for attention. And so you become extremely practiced at the process of suppressing one language when it's not appropriate, and you know using them as you see fit. And that seems to confer some benefits. It may also be that we see the strongest benefits in very young children and older populations, possibly because that's when executive function generally is less strong. So we know that executive function is at its peak among, you know, 20 and 30 year olds, and kind of declines quite quickly after that.
That makes me think of, we had some family friends who moved to Switzerland when their twins were babies, and the mother spoke to them in French, the father spoke to them in English, and the grandparents spoke to them in Swiss German. Mm-hmm. And the twins came up with their own mixed up language of all of them. And it was fascinating to hear, because you'd hear these little bits of familiar parts. What is it about youth that allows us to pick up languages so much more quickly?
Oh, there's various theories about that. And I mean, one of them seems to be just that the brain plasticity at that age and the number of connections that we make neurally is particularly heightened at that stage. There are also elements to the fact that children are less inhibited socially when they're learning languages. They tend to learn in immersive environments, as opposed to many of us who learn a foreign language might learn that in a classroom setting. So that seems to recruit a very different style of learning. So there are probably a variety of different components. And it's not the case that you can't learn to be fluent or highly, highly competent if you start in adulthood. Some do, but many people don't reach a native-like level of proficiency. And unfortunately, that often inhibits them from using that language. They feel that if they can't use it perfectly, that they're often reluctant to use that language. But as we talked about earlier, when you're in a multilingual environment, you're much more likely to lose that sense of inhibition quickly, as you see that people are just reaching for whatever they have in their bag.
Right. I'm a musician, and there's kind of a long-held understanding that once you learn to play one instrument, it's a lot easier to learn another instrument. Is it similar with languages?
Yes. Yes, it is. There's good evidence that exposure to multiple languages makes acquisition of new ones easier, even new accents. So there was a fascinating study that showed that if you exposed infants to a variety of non-native English accents, that they were then quicker to adapt to a new accent that they had never heard before than infants who were not exposed to non-native accents. So there's something about that exposure to multiple languages or even accents that seems to stretch our perceptual capabilities. Absolutely. Yeah.
When we talked, or when I introduced you, I talked about how we, as parents to be, we sometimes, it's almost an innate thing to talk to your belly. And as we find out, it's because we're really helping our child in the womb learn their native language. And it's so fascinating to me that, that the whole language acquisition. Can we talk through that a little bit? How and at what point an infant can recognize the sound of the native language versus another language?
Sure. So the answer to that is by birth, for some aspects of sound. So you have to remember that inside the womb, you're hearing sound through fluids and tissues and muscle and all of that. So you're not getting all of the details of speech that you do once you're out in the open air. So infants are absorbing those aspects of sound that can carry through basically their mother's body. So that mostly is the rhythmic properties, what we call the prosodic properties of speech. So if you expose a newborn, you play the sounds of their birth language to them, and then switch over to a language that has very different rhythmic properties, they notice the difference between the two. And they tend to, basically these studies are using pacifiers that are wired to measure the sucking rate of these infants. Because sucking seems to be linked to a baby's attention and alertness. So what you do is you play the languages of one sound and then you switch over to another. And it's a bit of a novelty effect. When the babies notice, oh, this is something different, they start sucking harder. It's a little bit of excitement, like, oh, I'm hearing something new. So that's the technique that's used to determine whether infants can detect a difference between languages. Now, if you play the sounds of a language that is very similar in rhythmic properties to the birth language, the babies don't distinguish. So that suggests that, you know, there's a limit to what they can learn in the womb. And it really is tuned to some of these rhythmic properties. But then, of course, once they're in the open air, it's a matter of months before they start being responsive to the sounds of their own languages in more detail.
Wow, that's so fascinating. So we have in our community about 25% of our population are native Spanish speakers. Mm-hmm. And with the next generation, these folks having babies and bringing them into the world, they're going to go to school in English. I have a friend that I was having a conversation with about this. He's a native Spanish speaker. His wife is a native English speaker, but has native-like fluency in Spanish. And I said, which language do you speak to your baby in? And he said, well, we're just speaking to him in Spanish because we know he's going to get English in school. And there was this part of me that wanted to say, oh, why doesn't one parents speak in English, the others speak in Spanish. And so let's ask you the linguist, maybe what you would suggest.
You know, I really understand that impulse because the evidence shows that the minority language really is at a disadvantage throughout the lifespan. So once kids begin school, once they enter a larger social environment where English is going to be spoken, the pressures are all against the minority language. So I think the parents' impulse there is to say, let's give Spanish as much of a boost as we possibly can to counteract this. Now, it's interesting that you say, why doesn't one parent speak one language and the other speak the other? Because for many families, that might seem like a weird and unnatural thing to do. And in fact, there's no reason why languages have to be divided up by parents. Kids, as we mentioned, they can distinguish even at birth between two different languages. So they do not mix up languages. If the same parent speaks both English and Spanish, the child is not going to be confused about which language is being spoken. There are tons of cues in the language itself that signal to the kid, this is one system, and you know, Spanish is one system and English is another system, and they can deal with that just fine. So that's, I think, something that is a little bit of a myth, that people think that they have to commit to one language or the other, and that's not really the case.
I thought, for anybody who's a word lover, you need to check out Julie Sedavy's new book, Linguophile. It had so many interesting little tidbits, like children are more willing to learn new words from someone who's formally dressed than someone who's dressed casually, how there's frequently a consensus about the ugliness of certain words. We've all heard people who get really freaked out by the word moist, and things like how the sounds of L and M appear more often in English words considered beautiful, and T and D are less often. What were some of the things that you discovered that you found really surprising or interesting?
This was just such an opportunity to read in areas and pockets that I might not otherwise have. I think that that whole area of what makes language beautiful fascinates me. There's very little research in that. I think to me, language has so much beauty. And much of that comes from the fact that, you know, we often think of language as a very utilitarian thing. It's for transmitting information. It's for passing knowledge from one person or generation to another. But it's so much more than that. It's really creeps into every single aspect of our lives and of the way that we relate to each other as human beings. So language is kind of connected to our bodily experiences, our emotional memories, our social relationships. And as a result, it just kind of drags with it all of the richness of human life. And I think that's what, as I was working on this book, really came into focus of attention for me. As a psycholinguist, I often spent a lot of time, again, thinking about the information structure of language, how we deal with that at a cognitive level. And this book was an opportunity for me to delve a little bit more deeply into kind of the fully human experience of language in an emotional and an embodied sense, focusing on the pleasure of it.
There really is a pleasure to language, isn't there?
Yes.
You just know, you recognize other language people. And even listening to you speak, you're such a precise speaker. And I wonder if, you know, our habits about the way we speak are affected by our love for language and the multiple languages in our past. Is there, with the rise of Duolingo and some of these opportunities to learn other languages, does that reflect anything interesting to you about culture? Is it a decent way to learn language?
Sure, there are plenty of language skills that you can pick up from Duolingo. There are some that you won't necessarily. And I think, you know, the question also applies to the rise of artificial intelligence and chatbots where you can use spoken language and not just written language. I think all of these present opportunities to learn many aspects of language. They won't replicate certain things, for example, the things that you mentioned about your experience in Japan, right? You really, that requires you to be immersed in the culture and to be interacting with people at that social level. But a huge amount of the information structure of language can be acquired in these ways. And that's very often a very efficient way to do it, especially for people who are shy in the early stages of using language with another person. You know, having an artificial agent with whom you can converse and not feel that sense of shyness, I think that's a wonderful opportunity.
Mm. Julie, when Mary Beth mentioned that you have very precise language, that's always something that I so admire, but it made me think of, I was reading Kris Kristofferson's obituary in the New York Times the other day. I loved Kris Kristofferson, but as many people know, he was a Rhodes Scholar and a poet and a writer, mm-hmm. and before he was ever, you know, who he became known to be, and he had a hard time in the beginning making it. His the way he wrote songs, it was too precise, and it was too rich in this kind of flowery language or whatever it was mm-hmm. that he used as a poet. And I read that it wasn't until he started using ain't and gonna and, you know, things like that that made it feel more like daily, you know, language that many people use. You know, that was sort of a big obstacle for him. And I just found that so interesting. And I'm wondering if you find these same kinds of things in your linguistic endeavors.
Oh, and you know, that's such a great example because it's really a type of code switching, right? And you can be extremely skilled in one kind of domain of language or one type of use of language and not in another. I see this often among academics who are very good at communicating with other academics, and then it's a challenge to maybe articulate their ideas outside of a setting where there's that shared knowledge and that awareness of like we belong to a group of people where we can take for granted that there's a knowledge base that we share. So that kind of fluidity across social settings, I think, is a tremendous skill. And I suspect is also easier if you have grown up multilingual and multicultural, because that is part of the multilingual experience. You know that language is used in different ways in different cultures, and you're able to adapt to that. So even if you're speaking English, but you're among a group of Japanese people, you might use your English differently. You have a different style of speaking. So that is a skill, that ability to switch between contexts is something that I admire tremendously. And when you see it in, you know, certain politicians, for example, that is, I think, a real asset.
Part three of your book is about loss. It's titled Loss. And so we're talking about language loss. And I love how you introduce it by saying you're around your 50th birthday and you found this to happen to yourself. And we all have this happen where we just cannot come up with the simplest of words. And, you know, maybe that's the beginning of this whole next phase of life that you talk about in your book. So can you just give us an overview of that whole part of your book?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's, I think, one of the things that I find so striking about language is its resilience in the face of constraint. And that's a big theme of the book. You know, at all stages of life, that language finds a way. We say life finds a way, language finds a way. If a group of people can't hear, they create a language with visual symbols. If they can't hear or see, they create symbols that use the skin and tactile forms of language. And similar things, I think, happen as we age, that we find ways to connect with each other and have richness of linguistic experience nonetheless. So one of the chapters deals with the phenomenon that it becomes harder to remember words as we get older, but that this is really a function of the fact that we have so many of them. So it's a question of access that is difficult. But that doesn't speak to the, you know, that in a sense just is an illustration of the fact that we have this massive storehouse of words in which we get lost. As we lose our hearing, I think that is for many, many people a sense of a source of isolation. They pull away from language. So I was trying to find opportunities for connection even within those contexts where we feel that we're losing some of our capabilities, but how do we manage to stay connected to each other? How do we tap into the richness of language to do that?
Well, it's a beautiful book, and it's
Thank you.
just so interesting to go along with you in your own sort of experience of language and then your expertise. The book is Linguophile, A Life of Language Love, and our guest is psycholinguist Julie Sedavy. Julie, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.